Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're right here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
And of course, Carol, that's part of a team of 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
And Jason, you can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio every weekday.
Or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
This is the guy I've been wanting to talk to try and make sense of everything that's going on a little south of us down in the nation's capital. He is our Washington Bureau Chief and Executive Editor there in the nation's capital, Craig Gordon from Bloomberg, joining us on the phone from Maryland. First, Craig, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm out here in Bethesda, Maryland, in the leafy suburbs, so I'm plenty removed from the action downtown, which would be about 3 or 4 blocks from where our office is. But
right.
None of us have been there in about 10 weeks, so we're feeling okay out here.
And tell me what is going on. I mean, you've got a team reporting on this all the time. I mean, I saw some pretty arresting images from Jen Epstein, who I know, you know, works very closely with you on our White House beat and others who have been documenting this. I mean, what do we need to know maybe that we haven't seen and the important context of what's going on with the president and the response right now in Washington?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think the thing that is important to remember right now is that Trump actually does have a lot of authority to do the thing that he said that he wants to do, which is potentially send U.S. troops into U.S. cities to try to sort of quell the unrest. You know, there's laws that date back to 1807 that allow him to do this. Usually they're only invoked when the local officials, the governor, the mayor, you know, sort of calls the White House and says, you know, kind of send in the troops. It happened during the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles when George H.W. Bush did it. There's some other instances scattered through history, but in most cases, it's local officials making the request. The law does, you know, does allow Trump to do it if he sees there's a need to do it or feels there's a need to do it, and essentially overrule the local officials. So it's something we're watching very closely. Now, Pentagon officials today held a briefing and told us, you know, they don't think that they will need to invoke this, you know, literally active military response. The National Guard and some of these states and cities can probably handle whatever the protesters can throw at them. But it's very much a live question. And I think based on the reaction, Trump's reaction last night, he's kind of itching to do it. So we're on pretty high alert for any kind of mobilization like that.
So, Craig, what do you make of what happened last night? So the president makes some comments, and then he does this walk, from what I understand, an unannounced walk, right, across the street from the White House through Lafayette Square to visit St. John's Episcopal Church. And then he holds up a Bible. So I don't know. What have you heard about that, and what was the president thinking?
Well, what our reporter, Jennifer Jacobs, who was actually on the scene, was in the press, you know, the press pool, essentially, when Trump made that walk, was that, you know, people may remember the New York Times, Bloomberg, and others reported that they had moved Trump into the sort of underground safety bunker at the White House on Friday night. George W. Bush went there on 9/11. You know, it does get you to Cheney, if anyone saw that movie. Mm-hmm. He was kind of hustled there pretty forcefully on 9/11. So, you know, it's used to keep the leaders of the nation safe. I don't think that was really an image that Donald Trump wanted kind of hanging out there, that he was, as his own son put it in a tweet, you know, sort of cowering in the basement while the protests were raging outside, outside of the White House. They seemed, Trump himself seemed kind of eager to erase that image. And what Jennifer reported was that in a meeting with the military leaders who were at the White House to discuss some of the response, he raised the possibility of walking over to St. John's Episcopal Church. And again, anyone who's visited the White House knows there's sort of a park right across the street, Lafayette Square, and then across from that is this church. I've been there many times on pool duty covering presidents through the years. It's a frequent Sunday stop for presidents, not so much Trump, but it's sort of right there. It's in walking distance of the White House. He sort of made the decision he wanted to give it a try. And when the president says that, the team sort of scrambles to try to make it happen. We're trying to sort out today exactly who gave the order or how it came down that the protesters were sort of cleared out from the front of the White House so that the president could make that walk, which is sort of essentially across Pennsylvania Avenue, across this rather small park, and then right to the following corner. There's some reporting right now that Attorney General Bill Barr, who people may have seen on TV, went over to kind of view the site before we knew Trump was going to make the walk, was the one who actually gave the order to kind of clear the park. That's a little bit in dispute right now. We're trying to get to the bottom of it in talking to Justice Department officials. But clearly an order was given because, again, anyone who saw the video and Jennifer Jacobs was there for us, you know, those military police cleared that spot out pretty aggressively, some tear gas, some riot shields, et cetera, on what at that point up till then had been a fairly peaceful protest. So, look, the imagery, if you're a fan of Donald Trump, the imagery was probably pretty dramatic. He's sort of striding through this kind of, you know, troubled area where this protest had just happened, goes to the church, holds up a Bible. Obviously, he's taking kind of withering fire on this from Democrats who say, you know, he essentially cleared out a protest simply for a photo op. The leaders, religious leaders, the Catholic Archbishop in Washington, the Episcopalian Bishop who kind of essentially oversees that church, you know, said it was sort of horrific that you would stage a photo op at a religious site with the Bible itself. So obviously very split opinions on that. I think Donald Trump honestly thinks he had a pretty good day yesterday.
Right. All right. So, Craig, we're going to continue our conversation in a minute. But before we go, just 30 seconds or so, what does the president do today? What's his state of mind today from what you can tell?
Well, I mean, I think you could say he kind of leaned into it a little bit. He did two things, you know, that you might say would be designed to appeal to religious voters. He voted. There was a shrine to Pope John Paul II, now Satan John Paul II, mm-hmm. out in Northeast Washington. He visited there. He signed an executive order on international religious freedom. So if anyone missed the subtlety of his actions last night, he reinforced it today with a pretty direct appeal to religious voters who were a big part of his 2016 coalition.
Now, we've been talking about what's going on, of course, across the country and President Trump and his team's response to it. Vice President Joe Biden, of course, also out there giving some remarks on the civil unrest facing communities across the country. He also weighed in on the president. Listen up.
The President of the United States must be part of the solution, not the problem. But this president today is part of the problem and accelerates it.
Let's bring back Craig Gordon, Washington Bureau Chief of Bloomberg News. Craig, Joe Biden, you know, obviously campaigning in a very different way because of the virus. I'm curious about how he addresses the president and his reaction, you know, what it might do for him, what it might do for the country.
Yeah, I mean, Biden has been, as people know, kind of in his home in Wilmington, Delaware, you know, kind of laying low because of the coronavirus, made his first venture out yesterday and now the speech today. I mean, you know, Joe Biden has to give a speech like this. It's kind of the tone you might expect, critical of Trump, kind of more, you know, sadness than anger, you might say, and kind of calling people to their sort of better angels. Obviously, you know, Joe Biden's a very familiar figure to a lot of Americans. Certainly people know he was vice president to Barack Obama twice. But, you know, I think Joe Biden prospers in this campaign just by looking like a kind of a steady, sensible alternative to Donald Trump. But ultimately, voters are going to decide on Donald Trump. It's really, this whole election's a referendum on Donald Trump. It was, we thought, going to be a referendum on his coronavirus handling. I think the marks on that are well in. There's a new Monmouth poll out today showing 74% of people in the U.S. say the country's on the wrong track. That is a dangerous number for Donald Trump. Pollsters always look at right track, wrong track. It's just a very simple way for people to kind of express frustration or fear about the direction the country's going. And with three quarters of the country saying wrong track, that's extremely bad news for Trump, 42% approval rating, which is very, very low. So Biden kind of can, you know, he can do well by just sort of showing up, looking steady, looking sensible. People know well he served Barack Obama, know well he has ties into the black community, a lot of support among African-American voters. That's why he became the nominee. So I think he just, like, don't make any mistakes while Trump is over here, you know, throwing gasoline on the fire. And I think that is all very helpful to Biden. The bigger, you know, way Biden can win this thing is by Trump's overreach and people thinking he's gone into a kind of a dangerous place and taking the country, as we say, down the wrong track. That's all good news for Joe Biden, some presidential hopes.
Right. And the whole notion, as we all know, historically, of, you know, are you better off 4 years ago? Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? I do want to ask you, Craig, before we let you go, you know, this relationship that the president and the administration is developing with the nation's governors and mayors, who certainly were at the fore of the coronavirus response and now are at the fore of the response to this. We talked at the top of the conversation about, you know, the president's willingness, more than willingness, maybe to send in the National Guard. But what does it tell us about sort of the more national political scene as we do see governors and mayors? And I'm thinking about Mayor Bottoms in Atlanta and other sort of governors and mayors coming to the fore. How does that change the political calculus, maybe even when it comes to the Veep stakes, as they say?
Excuse me. Yeah, I mean, Mayor Bottoms down there in Atlanta certainly making a case for herself to get a hard look from Joe Biden, who we know has said he will choose a woman for his vice presidential running mate. He's been encouraged by some of his prominent African American supporters to pick an African American woman. He's certainly got several to choose from in Kamala Harris, Stacey Abrams, also from Georgia, a few people like that. I think what's interesting is what we're going to learn here is how far Trump can push the Republican governors. While we have been on this phone call, the Texas governor, Abbott, just came out and said, you know, we don't need the U.S. military down here. As he put it, Texans can take care of Texans. So while Abbott was a person who was very eager to kind of push the reopening on the virus front and really kind of walk in lockstep with Trump on the idea that we need to get the economy back open, you know, and balance economic needs versus the danger from the virus, on this question, he's just drawing a hard line and saying, no, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to let U.S. troops march through the streets of Austin and Houston and all the places, Dallas in Texas. So I think where Trump is right now is that, you know, there has been very little reaction from Republicans.
Right.
You know, almost none have criticized his actions last night. Ben Sass from Nebraska is kind of a frequent Trump critic. No surprise there. But when you start to have the governors, who are, again, right on the front line of both the virus and the protests starting to push back, again, that suggests even they think Trump might be overreaching a little bit here, and that's pretty hardcore Republicans. Now what do those voters in the middle think? They may be thinking the same thing.
All right. Craig Gordon, always
Thank
a treat
so
to catch up
much.
With you. Thank you so much. Just love your context and your perspective. Craig Gordon is our executive editor and Washington Bureau Chief for Bloomberg, joining us on the phone from Maryland.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs.
The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You are listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Well, we can't lose sight of one of the other really big stories going on in the world, and that is another form of protest and another confrontation that's happening, and that is in Hong Kong and with Beijing and everything that's going on and the repercussions that it's having across the world. It's the subject of a story in Bloomberg Business Week this week. Joel Weber, the editor of the magazine, joins us from Brooklyn. Mark Champion wrote the story. Joel, help us understand the backdrop here.
So last week, a pretty significant event happened, which was really kind of looks like China moved on Hong Kong in a way, which has been obviously brewing for a while, for years, in fact. But it has really come to a head and accelerated during the pandemic with this law that that China has passed. A lot of China watchers and Hong Kong watchers are really fearing for the worst.
You know, it's really fascinating, you know, reading through this story, Joel, because, you know, the more I read about it, I'm like, wow, the similarities. And of course, it's not apples to apples, but this whole idea of just, you know, moving more aggressively into an area. Now, you know, mind you, Hong Kong is under, you know, the sovereignty, if you will, of China to begin with. But it is interesting how China and President Xi in particular are, you know, seemingly disinterested in what the rest of the world has to say about their increasingly aggressive moves.
That's right. And what Mark actually writes in this story is that there's a similarity to what's happening with Hong Kong and Xi's, you know, sudden aggression there, or really just the aggression there. And what actually we saw from Putin in 2014 regarding Crimea, which also was sort of this chess move at somewhat of an opportune moment for him. And, you know, the takeaways for both of these is just that, you know, while the world is dealing with other things and looking away, there are moves that are made that you cannot unwind. And that's sort of what we're seeing here in Hong Kong, which, you know, you guys mentioned, you know, there's this de facto system of government there where it's sort of two systems, one country. And that's supposed to last until 2047. And what we're seeing is that it might not last through the end of the year, really. So, Mark, I just wanted to bring you in. You know, you I think were the one who sort of said, you know, this is starting to look like a Crimea moment. And how has that sort of manifested itself from your perspective?
Yes. I mean, the key thing is, I think, if you think of this in terms of, you know, why did the Chinese do what they did? And what does it say about how they now view their foreign policy choices and the West? And then, you know, alternatively, if you also think about, well, what does it say about, you know, how the West can respond and, what can actually be done? And so if you think of it in those two ways, there is a lot to be found in common. So, you know, for from the first point of view, from the Chinese and, you know, what they are doing, this is a moment a little like, you know, Putin in 2014, where he took this decision knowing that it would, for the foreseeable future, destroy his relationship with the U.S., with the West. But he had come to a point where he decided there was, you know, that was what he wanted to do. It was actually valuable to him to work on anti-Americanism. He'd also given up on trying to work with the U.S. And really, we're at that sort of point with Xi now, you know, after a couple of years of trade war. Now you've had the stuff with the coronavirus and Trump describing it as a Chinese virus and so on. And the Chinese have really just decided there's not much to lose by doing stuff that the U.S. and the rest of the West will really be very upset about. And then secondarily, they also understand, as did Putin, that there isn't much that the U.S. or Europe can do to actually stop what, you know, the policy goals that they have. And these are quite historic goals, taking Crimea for Russia. I mean, in the Hong Kong case, of course, Hong Kong already belongs to China. Everybody acknowledges that. But to actually, you know, impose control on an area that was, you know, becoming quite embarrassing for Xi, he wasn't able to impose authority, order, and so on. And so, you know, in those two ways, I think they are, it is a sort of very useful analogy. Mm-hmm.
And Mark, how do you think this will play out for Hong Kong specifically, and then also for those other places in sort of Chinese gaze, like, you know, I'm thinking of Taiwan, for instance?
Yes. Well, I mean, the answer for Hong Kong is frankly not terribly well. So if you are a Hong Kong pro-democracy protester, you've been part of this movement, which has been quite, you know, formidable over the last year, then it's the implications of all this, A, that China no longer cares to hesitate because it doesn't worry so much about what it's going to, what the rest of the world is going to think or what it may lose economically. And secondly, that the U.S. And in particular and the rest of the West in general will be unable to do anything really for you. That these two things don't spell anything very good for you if you're in Hong Kong. And you have to really, deal directly in the end with Xi and the party in Beijing, and find a new way, try and persuade them. I suppose that this new law won't be so swinging that it will destroy the independent judiciary and so on that Hong Kong's financial center and prosperity is based. So for Hong Kong, it's a complicated future,
right?
And not a very promising one. And then for Taiwan, it's a little different. I mean, what the effect of the destruction, really, of the idea of a two-system country, one country, two systems, the effect of everything that has been watched over the last year from Taiwan, they watched very closely what was happening in Hong Kong, it's already been to really change the politics in Taiwan. You had a pro-independence president who was really trailing in the polls quite badly last year before these protests really got going and the police response got going. And then in January, she won re-election. And it's really changed the way that the Taiwanese think about the possibility of, becoming part of that policy of right. One country, two systems.
I have to say...
So,
It's very provocative, and it does make me, Mark, wonder, ultimately what's next in terms of this relationship between China and the United States. I mean, there's a line in there about China now being basically, America's arch enemy, which is not essentially where I think, if you go back a few years, where we all thought it was ultimately going. It's a must read. Mark Champion, thank you so much. Bloomberg News senior reporter for international affairs, joining us on the phone in London, along with our Bloomberg Businessweek editor, Joel Weber, on the phone in Brooklyn.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
It's time again for our Bloomberg Businessweek Small Business Survival Guide check-in. For that, we have Dimitra Kesanidis, editor of Bloomberg, on the phone from New Jersey. And so, Dimitra, set this up for us because you have very kindly delivered us someone to talk about exactly what's going on in this very uncertain time, already an uncertain time for small businesses, and it's only getting harder. Help us understand what's going on.
Yeah, Jason, thank you. I mean, it is really, gearing up for reopening. But the past week has been a very, very, very tough week, one of the toughest weeks in the United States, following the killing of George Floyd, protests, peaceful protests, then interrupted by people coming in, and looting and really creating much more mayhem. And so this affects small businesses really at their core, businesses and communities that are really integral to those communities. And so we have been spanning out talking to business owners across the country. And one of the first people that my colleague Nick Leiber, who's a contributor to Business Week, spoke to is Rashad West, who owns a restaurant in Minneapolis. He runs a restaurant across the street from the spot where George Floyd was killed. And we talked to Rashad about what it means to be running, you know, how do you move forward from this right now? And how do you navigate this point in time?
So, Rashad, come on in and welcome to Bloomberg Radio. You do join us on the phone in Minneapolis. And, first of all, we're so sorry for what your neighborhood is going through at this point. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing and what it's meant for you and your community.
Well, thanks for having me. Right now, we have very peaceful protests. The memorial is actually on the intersection right across from where my restaurant is. This area is really protected. The neighborhood's making sure nothing violent, dangerous is happening. So every day, we're coming in. People are grilling, passing food and water out. People are bringing their kids. And it's like really a healing space. So right now, the community is just coming together and showing solidarity for the Black community, especially.
And so, Rashad, when you sort of put all of this together, obviously the comeback was in part owing to a shutdown of the entire economy. How do these things, two very traumatic events in different ways, how do they affect your ability to really continue your business going forward?
I just think as a business owner, small business owner, you're always trying to figure out a way to navigate day by day. So right now it's just really pushing us to figure out how, one, we can support our community first, because, that's where we are, and they're the ones that allowed us in the neighborhood to open a business. So figure out how to support our community. And then, just after we start to find some balance, how we can provide again and continue to do business. So continuously adjusting as we all do, and making sure that people know we're here for them. That's really number one right now. We haven't really thought about much else.
Demetra, come on back in, because you've been managing the small business survival guide and the coverage, and it certainly has gone from so much focused on the virus to obviously it's so much more than that now.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rashad shared with me earlier and others that we're talking to that in a way, that now the virus, very important. It's important, of course, to still be wary of that, but that has become a secondary concern in some ways because this is fundamentally so much more challenging. But I think, as he also said, it's for many, take it a day at a time. Take the steps you can first to ensure that your community is okay, because without your community being okay, what's the point if your business is going to be okay in the midst of a community that is torn apart, that is, really sort of mourning or just trying to rebuild. So it is especially challenging right now. We've talked about so many things over the last few weeks having to do with, funding and money and loans, and this doesn't even come close to that level. But I think if there's a strong community to build on, as there are resources, your chambers of commerce and all, you'll find the support you need, and especially leaders like business leaders like Rashad, who see themselves as community leaders too, not just a business owner.
Rashad, just got about 50 seconds left here. Are you getting the support that you need, financial and other?
Absolutely. Community has rallied around everybody that lives in the area. Financially, we'll be okay. And then they did set up a GoFundMe just because, operations have completely stopped. So it was nice of them to do that, a friend to do that for our business. And, we're going to make it through, but we just got to make sure everybody is healed.
Right. Well, our hearts are with you. Good luck with everything. And we know it's an incredibly difficult time. But we also know that, you know, and we know this from Demetra's work and our own, that small businesses really are the backbone of communities, the backbone of this country in many ways from an employment perspective, but also as gathering places at times of great need where we all sort of need to lean on each other. Rashad West, he is the owner of Dragon Walk. It is in the Bryant neighborhood of Minneapolis. Our thanks to him as well as to Demetra Kessinides, looking after the Small Business Survival Guide, critical project at Bloomberg Business Week, Carol.
Yeah, and truly in the thick of it in terms of what we've been dealing with the virus over the last few months, and then, of course, with the death of George Floyd.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. Back with us is Kevin Barry. He's Chief Investment Officer at the Independent Registered Advisor, Investment Advisor, CAP Trust. He joins us on the phone from Raleigh, North Carolina. So, Kevin, nice to have you back with us. Tell us about life in Raleigh. How are you guys doing?
Well, you know, I came from New York City, in which case I would have been in an apartment for the last 90 days. I'm in a much better mood down here, and I know Jason's from Atlanta. One of the interesting things about here in Raleigh is it's actually affordable. You can actually be a hipster, buy a warehouse and convert it into a bar or something. So, you know, you can afford more than the hat, right? A lot of folks, it's so expensive. But here you can actually, there's so much happening. So many young people going to school here, staying in the area, working at biotech companies. It's a very vibrant area, and I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's a great town, you know, and you've got the whole, you know, Research Triangle Park thing going on. You've got, as you say, some great universities, and people love living there. One of my closest friends moved from New York back home there. She's a Wake Forest grad and has a great house in Raleigh and just raves about life down there. I do wonder, you know, being a step removed from New York City and, you know, some of the, especially the virus hotspots, and we can talk about some of the other things that are clearly going on in the world. You know, I do wonder if your lens is a little bit different for how you think about not just investing, but the economy.
Well, we do see, obviously we're not as, you know, people are much more socially distant naturally here, right?
Sure.
Because they're not taking subways to work, et cetera. So on the other hand, my niece, for example, is at Duke University. She's working on a COVID cure right now. So being close to the biotech means that we're kind of very close to what's happening in that standpoint. So, you know, the economy, it's interesting to see kind of outside of the city during this whole period of time, even when the quarantines are on, you can see construction work going on here, repaving, you know, sort of outdoor work was still happening here. So that has been pretty interesting.
You know, Kevin, one of the things that we've been talking to, we're going to talk a little bit later on, is with everything that's going on in the world, how ESG, I feel like all of a sudden everybody's coming out and saying, you know, check out our ESG platform. You know, if you want companies that stress equality, diversity, fairness, and the like, you know, then, you know, you're going to want to invest with us kind of thinking. And I do think it is important that companies increasingly move forward on these types of initiatives, because that can certainly money talks, right? And brings about changes in society. And I do wonder how, if at all, that is some of what you're hearing from some of your investors at CAP Trust.
That's a great question. We've actually been running that kind of money for over 25 years. You know, and a long time ago it was mostly what you're not going to buy. I don't like this. We don't like that. Right. And now we're incorporating many more positive aspects into it. But you know what's really interesting? Now, more than half of our employees are millennials. And for a firm to grow, we've been a rapidly growing firm, for a firm to grow, you have to attract talent. And you're getting grilled by the talent on your internal ESG policies even before you design products for clients. I think that's really interesting.
So when you look around the world and you sort of rank the worries, Kevin, you know, we've obviously talked a lot about the civil unrest over the past couple of days. Yeah. We've been talking for weeks and now months about the virus. But, you know, you think about what's going on between Beijing and Hong Kong and the U.S.-China trade tensions and political and economic tensions. How do you sort of rate those in terms of what could be the most disruptive for an investor?
Sure. So I think the China is very interesting right now. And you guys have probably done stories on it. There's a dollar shortage in Hong Kong. You know, people who are living there are trying to switch their Hong Kong dollar for U.S. dollar. And that's a sign. We see that in gold, right? And we see it in the continued strength of the dollar. Overall, I think it's what we've had the last 3 months is an extraordinary event. I've seen a lot of recessions and a lot of downdrafts, nothing like this. Actually, the shock does remind me of 9/11 a little bit and back to the 73-74 shock. But this is an extraordinary time. And I think it's also so meaningful that it's occurred during an election year, coming up to an election year, because we have seen bipartisan support for tremendous spending on the fiscal side and tremendous support on the monetary policy side. I'm not sure we would have gotten that much more support if it wasn't an election year, right?
Really?
So
interesting.
I think absolutely. I mean, who wants to go to the ballot box and say, I'm voting against loans to small business, I'm voting against higher unemployment benefits? So you have both parties. There doesn't seem to be anyone advocating much in the way of fiscal discipline right now, right? And I think part of that is it's election season. So
how could you though? I mean, above and beyond it being an election year, right?
Yes, I agree. But there are some folks who are very focused on deficit, you know, bringing down the deficit, reducing deficits, either through reduced spending or increased taxes. And right now, people are saying just what you're saying, Carol. Like, you know what? Let's just take care of people. Let's pass the bill and let's take care of people. And that's what's happening. And so I think I'm grateful that it's happening, but I'm also wondering if it would have been as generous if it wasn't an election year.
Sad. Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, that's my opinion, everyone.
the good thing is we got it, right? We've gotten this aid, and we'll probably get more aid. It's our expectation that there'll be another program probably later this month with additional aid, which we need, and I'm happy that we're getting it.
And so, you know, you mentioned 9/11, Kevin, and obviously something that folks looked at after that for obvious reasons was the travel industry, the airline industry. What do you see in this case? Because, you know, we're looking at, you know, volumes that are down 90%+. Is there short-term hope for that, or is this something that's a longer-term play? How do you look at that sector?
Sure. So, you know, I was in Manhattan in 9/11, and, you know, I remember a lot of, you know, that too well. There were a lot of people who said, I'm never going to fly again, just not going to do it. And airline traffic dropped precipitously over the next several months. But a year later, we were back to 90% of the airline traffic we had before. So it's interesting. The other thing that's interesting to me, and I actually had to read it, it was on Bloomberg, and I had to read it like five times, was some of the Carnival crews, somewhat a major sort of travel agency, saying that when Carnival announced that they were going to start sailing again, bookings were up, I think, 600% over the same period last year.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I would have thought that would be the very last thing to come back.
Yeah.
And yet there are people who want to continue to sort of go back to quote, normal.
It is. Yeah. It's an amazing world. All right, Kevin Berry, good to check in with you. Thanks so much for giving us the opinion and the insights down in Raleigh, North Carolina, Chief Investment Officer for CapTrust. Carol?
Resiliency, right?
Yeah.
Kind of comes back. It's interesting.
Thanks so much for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And of course, you can always listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube by searching Bloomberg Global News.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.